Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to this weekend's episode of Nevada Backcountry only on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. This week, we've got a couple special guests filling in for one, David Catalano, who I think is battling a severe case of diarrhea at the moment, but for whatever reason, he couldn't make it into the studio. So, little bit of housekeeping to get to before we jump into our special guests. We just shot the Fallon shoot this last weekend, and I think Danger Dave took second. He's on a hot streak. I shot the wrong target and wound up out in my car crying later, but sincere thank you to Ace and the Whole Archery, Hunter Morai, the entire Morai family. It was a fantastic shootout there. And one of my favorite parts about doing this job is I forget how much personal information I share. So we had a listener come up to us, Billy, who apparently knows Mike from Battleborn Tree Service. Man, great to meet you. Thank you for introducing yourself and thank you for listening to the show. With that out of the way, Lexi McPherson and Emily Reed are co-hosting the show with me today. So Lexi, you got in touch with us through Instagram, sent us a message on there. What is your Instagram account?
Nevada Queen Bee.
Where's that come from?
I moved away from Nevada for a long time. I was a beekeeper for a long time too, so it just kind of went. I love Nevada.
You still do the bee thing?
I don't. I ran about 10 hives for 5 or 6 years during the Y2K.
Pandemic. Y2K or yeah. Pandemic?
No, the OG.
Oh, the original.
Everyone's going to die.
Yeah.
So I kept bees and did it for several years after that. And then there was a big problem with the colony collapse.
Right.
And so I just quit trying.
But that was where the Instagram handle comes from.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating page. You are a falconer.
Correct.
First one on the show, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Falconry is something that's always interested me, but the big hurdle for me getting into it was that you've got to do like a 2-year apprenticeship or something.
Yes, and that just comes from falconry is a super old sport, one of the original ways of hunting. And back in the medieval times or whatever, they did apprenticeship for every job pretty much. And so that's kind of something that's stuck around. Also, a lot of fish and game people that are in charge of licensing us and registering us don't know anything about falconry. So there's nowhere else for us to really learn. And because we have your first 2 years wild-caught raptors, it's very important that we do the best we can in taking care of those. And so what better place to learn than from a falconer that's been there and done that? So that's kind of how that
goes. What's the commitment? Like, as far as how long do they live?
Well, it depends. I think the oldest red tail in captivity that's a falconry bird is mid-30s, but in the wild, 10, 15 years is average.
Mid-30s?
Yeah.
So but it's a commitment. It's like getting a horse or something.
Yeah, and not only that, I think, you know, a lot of raptors, just like in nature, will get electrocuted. They get shot sometimes if we're out hunting. Golden eagles are huge because they're very territorial, so they'll kill our birds for no reason just to get them out of the field. You know, disease is a big one. West Nile, they get bird flu. I know a lot of falconers the past couple of years that have lost birds to that. So it's not, there is a lot of problems that can happen. I think there's a saying that somebody told me once that, you know, there's 1,000 things that can happen when you take your bird out, and only one of them is good, that you go home with your bird. So,
gotcha.
You know, we're not taking these birds out of nature when we go hunt with them. They're cut loose. They're free to do whatever they want.
Right.
And, you know, nature, that includes if a coyote hears a rabbit screaming when our birds catch them, they're going to run in. So we have to be right there to keep, you know, I mean, there's so many things.
We will do a deep dive on the falconry stuff. But first, introduce yourself as far as where'd you grow up? Where do you live now? What's your 9-to-5?
I am third generation Renoite, and we came from a big Italian family here in Reno, and I was here till I was 18, and then moved to a little town called Miwok Village, California, in the Sierra Nevada, and raised my 5 boys, and the minute I left Nevada, I wanted to come back. I just missed it. It's my home. I love the desert, and then moved back to Reno when my boys were older, and got divorced, and I have a background in horses I worked at a vet hospital for a while, 7 years. And then I got back into the horse thing after I got divorced because I could, you know, had more time to do what I wanted instead of, you know, what everybody else needed. So I got back into that. I got a job at Ghost Ranch in New Mexico as a wrangler, taking people out on horseback. And then I got a job outside of Yellowstone on the east entrance outside of Cody and Wapiti Valley. And then I got a job in Colorado at a fox hunting ranch there, took care of 9 horses and 30 foxhounds. And I think I was 11 or 12 when I joined the hunt club here in Nevada, the Red Rock Hounds.
Oh, and yeah, yeah, yeah.
With
okay.
Them for a long time. And that's kind of how I got started in hunting with hounds. And.
But you've been outdoors basically your whole life, It sounds like.
Yeah. And we come from not really a hunting family, but definitely a nature outdoorsy family. Our grandpa was a deep sea fisherman. He caught, you know, big sailfish and swordfish. And then on my dad's side, they lived in Hawthorne, Nevada. So I did a lot of fishing on the Walker River and lake and learned how to fish and drive a boat and shoot.
Before we walked in here, I asked you if you did any big game hunting.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you've been around it, but not something that interests you.
I never got my license to go do it. And I don't know why. I've learned how to, you know, throughout my years ranching and, you know, that kind of thing that I could process a pig, a cow, sheep, goats. I've done all that. Rabbits. But I just have never committed to the big game hunt. So okay. One day maybe I will.
So why the falconry thing?
So I have always wanted to do falconry. I think I was in elementary school when I read My Side of the Mountain and you read about Frightful, his peregrine falcon that he trained. And I was just like obsessed, just, you know, having a wild bird that you can train to hunt. And then I just knew when I was raising my boys, I didn't have enough time for it because it's a huge time commitment. It's a lifestyle, really. I mean, your whole life revolves around it. So that was kind of what made me do it. I just waited and waited. And then when I had time to do it, I just called. I was in New Mexico at the time and called the New Mexico Falconry Association and got in touch with some great guys. And they, you know, I would go out hunting with them the first probably 6 months, the end of the season. And then, you know, they wanted to make sure that I was going to be okay with everything. And that's how that happened. And those guys with New Mexico Falconers, you know, that in the 70s and 60s, when the peregrines were on the endangered species list, I think they got put on the endangered species list in the 70s. And that was because a DDT was making the shells really fragile.
Right. Yeah.
And so the New Mexico Falconers used the peregrines from New Mexico because they didn't farm in New Mexico because it's such crappy farming there. So they were able to use those falcons and made thousands of peregrines that have been distributed all over the United States to bring them back. And now they're off the endangered species list. But those were, like, the Peregrine Fund got started, and one of the original falconers that I flew with, he was, Tom Smiley was one of the guys that helped get all that started. And
so before we go to break here, falconry, on the rise or declining?
I think it's on the rise. I think there's close to 4,000 falconers, licensed falconers in the U.S. I don't think all of them are necessarily practicing falconry right now. And the definition of falconry is hunting with a bird of prey.
Okay.
So if you're not hunting and you just have a pet barn owl, that's not falconry.
Oh, gotcha.
You know,
okay.
You actually have to get out. And I go at least 4 days a week, but I'm usually 7 days a week taking my birds out for a couple hours at least to hunt. And we have a season from
It's a long season, right?
Yeah, from September 1st to March 1st. And during that time, we can hunt upland birds and cottontails. And jackrabbits don't have a season.
Well, when we come back on Nevada Backcountry, let's get into some of the minutia of falconry. I've got some questions as far as how the birds select prey or if it's just a free-for-all out there. Don't go anywhere. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. If you are just tuning in, the show is Nevada Backcountry on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Shout out to our show sponsor, Shooting Performance Institute. April 27th is the positional rifle course, and May 18th is the Hunter's Challenge. Get in touch with Jim. Make sure you are as prepared as possible before you go out into the field this season. Because I know if you listen to the show, you're definitely guaranteed a tag. It's Dave and I that tend to strike out on those things. Special guests in studio today, Lexi McPherson and Emily Reed. One of the things that fascinates me about falconry, with falconry, it kind of seems like it's a throw the bird up there, let it do its thing. How do you keep track of what they're going after? Or do you not?
No, I do. And we have, you know, strict guidelines that we have to follow. If we get certain migratory birds, we have to leave them where they lay or take them in and report it or whatever if they catch something weird.
You already answered my next question, which was going to be some of those, the federally regulated stuff. Like, what happens if they decide to crush a dove and it's not in season or something?
Like, my birds have caught a short-eared owl before, and I just have to run in as fast as I can and make sure the owl's okay and just let it go.
What if it's not? Like, legitimately, what do you do?
We do have to report it. We either take the body in to a game warden out in Winnemucca, where I live, or depends on the bird. But we are licensed federally and through the state, so we do have to follow all the same regulations as everybody else.
What if it caught one of your neighbor's cats? Would you tell your neighbor, or would you try to replace the cat?
I wouldn't replace. I hate cats. I hate cats outside. So do the quail population.
That's fair.
What do you do with them at home?
They have a perch, so you'll notice red tails mostly just sit on a telephone pole most of the day until they find something. So, you know, I don't feel bad about it as long as my birds are getting out every day and flying and, you know, that kind of thing. When they're at home, they just sit around and rest. They don't really want to do much.
Talk me through the process real quick, because I know, again, plug your Instagram page. It's fantastic.
Nevada Queen Bee.
Yeah.
So she takes all those photos. Like, Lexi's a really talented photographer too. Real.
No, it's phenomenal. Yeah. It's incredible. But I notice you post a lot of pictures of your dogs.
Yes.
Do those play a part in the hunting cycle or whatever?
100%.
Okay.
My first year as a falconer, when you're an apprentice, you need to fly either a kestrel or an American kestrel or a red-tailed hawk.
Okay.
Because the populations are large, we don't worry about, you know, if something happens, we're not going to, if you get somebody that sucks at falconry and ends up killing a bird, the population isn't going to suffer.
Right.
Number one. Number two, red tails are very opportunistic. They're great, versatile hunting bird. And so the first year that I hunted with my red tail, I was hunting mostly cottontails and some jackrabbits here and there in New Mexico. And I was running around, the rabbits would go to ground and I would have, you know, no way to get them out. Also, I can only zigzag through a field so many times, and cottontails will hold tight in a bush. You pretty much have to kick them out if you've got a hawk on your fist, you know. So adding a dog to the team was a game changer. I mean, we got so many more flushes. We got a lot more catches.
Okay.
So
do you train them like a traditional, like an upland bird? Do they point or what? How do you train the
dogs?
So
I have a GSP and I have a Flushing. I have a English Cocker Spaniel.
Okay.
Field bred English Cocker. So we pretty much just ran like feral morons the first year trying to figure it out. You know, the pointer was just learning what he was supposed to be doing, and the Cocker's just a spaz because he's, you know, a Cocker Spaniel.
Right.
So now they've gotten mature enough and I know how to train how I kind of want them to work, that I'll let the pointer run out in front of us, keep the Cocker at a heel or closer to me, flushing game right in front of me and the birds. And then when the pointer is on point, I'll send the Cocker in once I catch up with the hawks and give them a better chance of flushing.
And you do all this by yourself?
Yes.
You're running two dogs.
Yeah.
You've got a...
Sometimes three. I bring my Australian Shepherd too. She comes along with us too. So.
And all by yourself?
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. It's great. Because
she doesn't like it when other people are there.
Well, if something happens, I don't have to worry about it. Yeah. You know, if I cuss out my dogs, nobody's there to be like, ooh, make me feel bad about it. Or, you know, if the birds take off after a jackrabbit that's a quarter mile away, I don't have to stress out that somebody's going to be pissed because they're
lazy,
you know,
and they don't want to walk.
Yeah.
But you invite Emily.
I did. Her and my brother came out with me, and
I passed the test.
The birds caught a cottontail, and I don't think they saw it.
Well, did you see it?
Yeah, I was right there.
Oh, yeah,
there.
She went and... Oh, yeah.
I have to be close.
Should I use the microphone?
Jackrabbits will mess my birds up. I mean,
oh, will
strong.
They really?
Yeah. And any bird of prey that catches something large like that,
yeah,
the rabbits don't die usually right away. Eagles can take care of them by themselves.
Right.
But for my birds, I fly two Harris Hawks, so they kind of help each other hold it until I get there and dispatch the rabbit for them. But they'll just start eating it alive, and I don't want that to happen either. I kind of, you know, as a falconer, it's our responsibility to hunt politely, too, and have some...
Ethical.
Yes. Yeah.
What was your impression? Emily, we're going to get to introducing you on the show in a minute. You've been extremely patient.
Thank you.
But what was your impression of the whole thing the first time you went out?
Oh, well, I always talk to Lexi about the whole process. So I had an idea. Like, I thought it was interesting when she first started hunting that the two kind of wrestled each other at one point, right? The hawks had to learn how to get along.
Yeah, because they're not related. And so
they had some,
Harris
they
hawks
did a little
will hunt together. They're one of the only hawks that will cooperatively hunt together.
Gotcha.
Red tails will too, but it takes a lot of, you know,
yeah.
They naturally will do it.
It was just awesome to see her work because she has everything. It sounds chaotic, what she just described, three dogs and two birds and rabbits running around and whatever other factors. But you just have a system, and it was awesome to watch you, actually. See the birds hop around. The birds are super cool.
What part did you play in it when you went out?
I was like a cheerleader.
You held the tea perch for a while.
What was it called?
The tea perch.
Oh, the tea perch. The long pole. How 4.5 feet, 5 feet?
Yeah.
And then the birds. So if you're in the flat desert, you're holding the perch up high so the birds can get a higher view.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. So what do? You pick a field or whatever, so, and you go, okay, we're going out here. You sucker somebody like Emily into it with a tea perch? And what, you just start quartering the field? You follow the dogs? What?
Yeah, so at the beginning of the season, because raptors are they're confident-based hunters, so at the beginning of the season, I'll take them to a field that's maybe closer to town that's packed full of rabbits. So that they get a lot of opportunities. They successfully catch and everything goes well. Then I'll add the dogs to that.
Okay.
And then by the end of the season, I can pretty much just open the back of the truck and let my birds and dogs out and they'll come get me when they're done. The birds will see a rabbit and take off and my dogs know they're on something. So my dogs will follow them. Same thing when the dogs get birdie, they're on a rabbit, my birds know and they'll fly over there and get ready for something to come out. So they really do learn how to cooperate and use each other in the field.
It's cool to see because birds don't normally like dogs. So it's just kind of cool how they've figured each other out. I'm sure if there was another dog, your birds would be like, no.
Oh, yeah, they'll scream at them.
Yeah.
I know when a coyote's in the field, the birds scream.
Oh, so the dogs actually even know the birds.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah,
okay. Because
her dogs will still eat other birds, right? Like, don't they want your pigeons?
Oh, yeah, they'll go after. But
like
they know,
good,
and I think there's a lot of body language that goes on that maybe we don't see, but they don't want to get grabbed by a hawk.
Right.
Australian Shepherd did have to get grabbed by a red tail before she would respect them when they were on something. But my Cocker has been so respectful since the day I got him. He's never gone in when they've got a rabbit or anything. So,
you keep talking about rabbits. You also, you hunt upland birds with them too, right?
Correct. My Harris Hawks aren't the fastest birds, so if there's quail in the field, they're usually in a huge covey.
Yeah.
So we'll have the dogs break them up a bit so that we can hunt like three or four in a bush at a time, because when they fly out and there's 80 quail, my birds don't even know what to do. They're just like, what the hell?
Overload?
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And so we'll break them up and then we'll go try to pick them off. But quail are fast and chuck are faster, so it's hard for my birds to catch them. So
weren't you thinking about getting a goshawk?
Yeah. I'm going to do an imprint goshawk one of these years so that I can go out and catch those guys, because it's that would be a game changer for me. But it's still fun. I still love chasing the birds, and the dogs learn and they get to learn, you know, a lot about.
We talked about it after we heard your show on women getting into hunting. You had mentioned maybe looking for places where chucker are. I know you know where places chucker are, but like how some of the men are kind of.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, and I get it. I would never, ever ask anybody where to find game. Like, you're a hunter. Go out and figure it out. And I live in Winnemucca, so I can pretty much take any dirt road I'm going to come into bird. So the thing that's cool about falconry, though, is the birds that gun hunter would be a jerk for taking on the road, I am able to get my birds a better slip
right.
and better opportunity by taking those birds that are maybe too close to town for shooting. You know, those are the places where I wouldn't feel like a douchey hunter.
Yeah.
What about weird stuff like snowcock? They're big, they're fast, they live at high elevations.
I have a dream, but I have, since I got into falconry, wanted to get a goshawk, used to being up there around the mountain goats, because I think snowcock love hanging around the mountain goats. Get those mountain goats used to me all summer long and just be able to bring my bird up when it's hunting season and just cream me, get me one of those guys. But it would be, I mean, that would be...
That'd be way cool.
It's probably unrealistic, but it's a dream. And it's fun to think.
I bet you do.
I will support you in that dream. I think that would be awesome. But you're going to have to make me a deal.
Yep.
I get to tag along if you do that.
I would love that.
We have got to take a quick break on Nevada Backcountry. Do not go anywhere. More with Lexi McPherson and Emily Reed when we come back. Get a jump on summer tree care. Call Battle Born Tree Service. For hunters, by hunters, Mike is a phenomenal guy. Give him a call and buy yourself some time to scout this summer. You're listening to Nevada Backcountry on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. And we have Lexi McPherson and Emily Reed in studio. We finally got Emily to talk the last segment. I'm going to give this segment to you, Emily.
Thank you, finally.
Who are you?
I'm a wannabe hunter. I'm a beginner. Yeah, I am. Good call.
Thanks.
It's my cousin Lexi. Shout out. Woo.
I forgot that little piece of the puzzle when we started. You two are cousins.
We have like 32 first cousins.
So, Emily, thank you for agreeing to do this. Dave and I have talked about you on the show before. I met you through the Hunt and House Archery League. And then, shoot, we just, last night we shot the outdoor thing. At Carson, we've now dragged you to
Fallon
for the tournament. You shot extremely well out there.
Okay. Carson. Yeah.
Well, so you sucked really badly in Fallon, but Carson went better.
It did. Carson was first, so I had like a false sense of my
confidence.
Skills. Yeah. And then I got to Fallon, and I was like...
So here's why you are fascinating. You were a vegetarian at one point.
Truth.
True story?
She was.
And I pointed at Lexi because when I first ate meat, she videotaped me and she was laughing.
It was that big of a deal.
Oh, to me, because I'm like, meat, you know, and Emily's like, so yeah, I was proud of her for trying.
I know. It makes me sound like an a-hole. Can I say a-hole?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, maybe it does. Maybe to your listeners. But so when I was a kid, I learned about factory farming.
Okay.
And so I was like, that's, that's messed up.
So the factory farming thing.
The factory farming thing is terrible.
Right.
Yeah. It trashes the planet and it's unethical.
Okay.
So I gave up meat. And I always thought if I did eat meat, it would be hunted. And so I ate fish, which I think commercially is kind of like a commercially hunted animal. As I got older, I needed a way to get more protein. I thought I should start eating more protein. And I started eating a lot of fish. But being in Nevada, it seems kind of silly to eat all that fish. And so I started trading with hunters. I'm an artist, so I traded artwork for meat. It's delicious.
You jumped the shark on the second one there. I was going to ask you what your 9-to-5 is.
Oh, okay.
Because that's another fascinating thing.
Yeah. So I'm an artist, and I teach kids art classes, too. In fact, I'm going to teach your kids some art classes this summer. So
that is true. Yes. Yeah. So you're an artist, former vegetarian.
Yeah.
And now you've decided to hunt. And what I think is admirable about you is you have decided archery is the thing to do. And even though I really put the screws to you as far as using a shotgun on a turkey.
Oh, yeah. So I listened to you and Dave on your episode. So you guys were talking about me, but you were saying that I really wanted to shoot turkeys with a bow.
Yeah.
And so I was just thinking, no, that was not what happened. But
did we get... All right. So, hey, so, here is your opportunity to correct the record.
Yes. Because no one in my family hunts, Lexi does, but not the way that I want to learn. Like, I don't have a dad, boyfriend, husband, brother who hunts. And I could have a mom, sister, wife, whatever, who hunts, but I don't. So there's no one. So I'm trying to learn. And then when I hear people talking about hunting, and like you kind of mentioned, I could go turkey hunting, I jumped on it. So I'll take any opportunity to learn. And I assumed because we were at hunting house shooting bow and arrows that that's how we do it. But it's not my number one. I would really like to shoot a pronghorn because that was the most delicious. Although tied now is the moose that gave me a couple moose steaks.
Oh, that's right. I did. Yeah. Okay. So your first choice would be what, like horns shorter?
I don't care.
Just a low pressure, easy.
Yeah, whatever. In fact, whatever you and Dave recommend.
Okay.
Like, I'll just seek out the experts. Where do I, you know, put in for tags and for what?
We will do that.
Yay.
All right. So let's back up from the hunting for a second.
Okay.
We've had a guest or a couple guests on now talking about kind of the hurdles for women getting into hunting. And one of the universal things that always comes up is just some of the outdoors stuff. So do you have any experience in the outdoors growing up?
Okay. I always loved being in nature, but I mean, we barely camped. We fished a little bit. You know, there's a lot of abalone diving. I don't know if that counts as, you know. But
100% it does,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah. So over in Fort Bragg, my dad would go every year. We'd tag along most of the time. Yeah, I just like nature, but I don't know how to hunt it.
So what, like...
harvest it.
Backpacking, camping, that sort of stuff.
We grew up riding horses, catching lizards.
Correct.
I mean, all of that.
Yeah. I've always trail run. Do I get points for that? Okay,
yes.
Good. Okay. How many points am I at?
Three.
Out of what?
Eight.
Okay. Well, I'm going to bring something else up. I could be...
Yeah. That was something that last weekend's guest, Jamie Martinez, and...
She's a city girl.
Yes, she is.
Yes. So we're not all the same, but it's not.
So that's not a hurdle.
I don't think it's a male-female thing. It might be easier for a guy, but like we have no problem going to the bathroom outside.
Yeah. if I was too embarrassed.
That's true.
So that's not a barrier to entry for you. What else have you experienced so far getting into hunting or wanting to get into hunting that you thought, boy, this would be a lot easier if I were a man?
Lifting stuff? Lexi's giving me lifting stuff.
I think like hiking out with an elk or something is like a nightmare I have.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how to process an animal.
A quarter at a time and then it would be way more hiking than I would want.
Yeah, you'd have to take a buddy. Well, how about just getting, like I had a neighbor who took me on a deer hunt and I know my neighbor and he's super awesome. So there wasn't any weirdness. But there are, I'm trying to meet people and not be so like, hey, let me jump in on your favorite thing to do, please. But to kind of put it out there, I'd love to learn how to hunt and then kind of making sure I'm not hunting with a weirdo. Yeah. So it's just, how do you navigate it so that I'm not like, hey, take me on a hunting date, you know? And also do you want me around? Maybe they don't.
I mean, I get that. If somebody just randomly came up to me and was like, oh, I want to take the falcons out. I want to go hunting so bad.
Yeah.
First of all, you called my hawks falcons, so you're not invited. But I just feel like there is this delicate balance, I think, between helping somebody out and inviting yourself to do stuff. And I know a lot of falconers that are more than happy to take me out when they're going gun hunting so that I can learn how to hunt chucker without my birds.
You know, just
have my dogs out and see how the birds act and all that kind of stuff that you can learn so much. But you also don't want to be like, blindfold me so I don't know where you're taking me. So you don't show me any spots.
Right.
You know, it's not so
straightforward. And there's like more. So if you're a kid and you don't have any hunters around you, it's difficult. However, there's so many programs for kids. And when I met Julie in the what's Julie's last name from the Fallon shoot who won? She works for the Department of Wildlife.
I forget.
Okay, sorry, Julie. But she was saying like there are classes that they have offered and will offer for women only because there's certain questions that you might feel more comfortable asking just in a group of women rather than men, because maybe it's something that most men are taught.
A lot of times people think they want to go hunting, but then my birds catch a rabbit and it's screaming its head off and I have to go over and kill it.
And it sounds like a little baby.
It's not.
Oh, yeah. But that's, I mean,
or
that goes for...
my birds are eating it while it's alive and it's like trying to get them off. It's brutal. Yeah. And I think if you just want to come meet the birds, then come meet the birds. But don't think...
Say you want to hunt and then, yeah. That goes for big game hunting too.
Exactly.
Like everybody likes the idea of it. Oh. And then when it's like 5 days living out of a pack in the middle of nowhere and you've turned up one forky and you're like, oh, this sucks.
Or you get close and over the hill they go and you're just like,
it was 10 days of work.
Back up. Yeah. It's just like, it's no joke.
The idea of hunting is always more appealing than actually hunting.
Well, I think that has a lot to do with people posting stuff online too, of just the glorious parts of hunting. You know, there's a lot. There's a lot of people that sell themselves as these great hunters, but it's like, doesn't always go that way.
It's all filtered.
And how many of those come off private land versus public? And how many? Yeah. No, I'm with you on that for sure. Nobody posts the, like, this is my third day with Giardia next to this elk wallow in the middle of nowhere. We're going to pause right there. When we come back, final segment of Nevada Backcountry coming up.
Hi, Mom.
Welcome back. Final segment of Nevada Backcountry coming up right now. If you miss a segment of the show or the show entirely, we are available on Apple Podcasts and shortly here Spotify. You can also go to 991fmtalk.com, click on the podcast tab, and all past episodes are there. We're in studio today with Lexi McPherson and Emily Reed. Emily, we left off talking about threading the needle between, is this a date or is this a mentorship? Am I learning to hunt? So the question I was going to pose to you is, what is stopping you from just learning on your own?
Nothing. That's what I'm doing. Oh, you mean just going out and doing it?
Yeah.
Well, if it gets to that, that's what'll happen.
I have been sending you pins on Onyx of every place that I see the pronghorn.
Yeah, yeah. So when Lexi's out there.
In Winnemucca. Yeah. But the problem with that is that their behavior changes
through the
during hunting season.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, or where they're all together or where they separate. So I don't even know if that is doing anything.
Yeah, Henry, I'm going to do it. I just, like, I would like to be efficient and figure out the best route to doing that. So, but nothing's stopping me. I'll hunt.
Well, I'm not going with her and hiking 70 miles and not getting something. Okay.
There you go.
So that is why she's going to try to find somebody to mentor her.
So do you ever stop, like when you're dropping pins, do you ever stop and look at maybe what they're feeding on, the terrain features, kind of tuck that away as, okay, they like this type of habitat?
Yeah. And I do that when I'm out with my birds. If I'm hunting jackrabbits, you know, for instance,
they like
and we come
this,
up to quail. Or I'm in between a mountainside and sagebrush, and it's just grass, and I find huns or something. I keep track of all of that. And, like, that's how I've learned pretty much how to find things, is because I pay attention when I'm out. I don't just, you know. Or where the cattle are. If the cattle are running on a field, are the pronghorn with them? Are they away from them? What kind of, you know, why are they following them? That kind of thing. But, again, this is like, it's like reinventing the wheel. Right. If somebody already has this information, why are we learning from trial and error when somebody could just.
Yeah, but I always use the example of there's 20 years of experience and there's 1 year of bad experience repeated 20 times. And if you don't know what you don't know, how do you know that you're not getting or the guy that or gal that goes and whacks something on a private ranch and is now a subject matter expert on all things mule deer, right? Yeah,
and like in falconry, I've never met a falconer that thinks he's an expert. Everybody's always learning. You're always learning. I never go out in the field and it's the same hunt every time. It's always different. I'm always tweaking things and, you know, doing things different. And I think it's the same way. You just want to make sure that if you're taking the time to go out there and you got a tag, which isn't, you know, they're not just handing those out.
Right.
You get one, you don't want to waste it.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know? Nobody wants to do that. But I think there's enough information out there. And I always look at stuff like the biologist notes on like where they find. And, you know, over time, you start to kind of develop that sense of like, okay, this bull faces this way. It's got this feed, this forage, this cover. They're generally
like
going to be animals
like how
there.
Often are they coming to this guzzler?
Right.
Is there a certain
how many times
time?
A day do they need water?
And are you allowed to hunt by the guzzlers?
Yes, 100%.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that either. So
here's what I love about hunting without going way off the rails is animals learn and adapt too, right? Herds change. So if an elk herd figures out like every time we go in here, the herd bull winds up tipping over and dies, we're probably not going to hit that guzzler. Or every time we go in here, here's a knock against folks, but you know, there's a side-by-side parked here and there's eight beer cans and a pile of trash. They're not going to hit that anymore. So there's always, you never stop learning, like you alluded to with the Falcon thing. But I think there's enough information out there that would at least point you in the right direction as somebody that wants to get into hunting.
But here's the thing. I gave Emily those pins and then she talked to you guys and you said, oh no, this is a better area. So like that kind of stuff, yeah. We didn't know that, oh, there's only two tags given in.
Well, I mean, it isn't in that book. It's like four, I think, four.
The hunt book, yeah.
Yeah. Four, yeah.
But, well, I invited myself to their dinner where they're going to put in for tags, so I'm going to show up.
It's our draft day.
Yeah. So are you guys going to teach her so that next year she doesn't need you? Because
I mean, that's the goal, at least for me with anything, is like, you know, same thing with my bird dogs. And you talk about that where, like, your birds will learn over time and they have that confidence boost or those confidence hunts. Same thing, right? Like, I'll start my season at chucker spots where I know, okay, birds will hold tight. It's generally not super rocky. Like, we'll get into birds and they'll start to develop that confidence as the season goes on. Then by the end of the season, you can take them into spots. But if I have to be beeping a dog or whistling at a dog or whatever by the end of the season, I screwed up somewhere. So as I'm saying this out loud and I'm thinking through this, I'm not equating teaching a female to hunt as training bird dogs. But what I'm saying is, yeah, absolutely. Any new person you get into hunting, the end state would be for them to teach you something at some point. Or like, hey, I found this herd of elk in this area and, you know, it's something new that I don't know.
And I think that's the experience that I've had with a lot of falconers too. I've never had a bad experience where somebody was scared to give me information, what field to hunt in maybe, or, you know, that kind of a thing has been, I'm so thankful for the hunters that have taught me that kind of thing because I couldn't have, you know, it would take me forever to figure it out.
Right.
But
yeah.
I mean,
it shortens the learning curve for sure to have somebody involved.
And I think just being out too, like the, you know, I would watch the chucker come down the hills and get into the creek and drink and then they didn't want to fly as much after that.
Yeah.
I'm like, ching, ching. Like, to me, this is my chance.
Totally.
But as soon as the snow fell on the higher, they wouldn't come down anymore. So all of these things were like a learning experience. But I could have probably spent an hour talking to any chucker hunter and learned that.
Yeah.
But I didn't know.
True.
And I've just learned it from watching and
paying attention.
Yeah.
Yeah. All of that absolutely makes sense to me. Emily, besides like a dead antelope on the ground, what would be a goal for your first season as a hunter?
For any dead animal, you're saying?
Yeah. Take the kill out of it. What would be one takeaway that you would want to get out of the whole thing?
I only get one. Well, this whole process, I've been learning so much. So like just, you know, taking the hunter safety course last year and then learning that archery probably fits in better, you know, what I like or want to do. I guess, I don't know why you want me to just choose one.
So okay, rattle them off. We'll go all of them. What would make a successful first season for you? Barring just like meat in the freezer.
Getting to go on a few more hunts.
Okay.
Yeah, just the experience, for sure. I mean, I want to get a tag and I want to go out there and do it. But also, I want to go out there and enjoy it and learn to you know, look for whatever it is I'm supposed to look for to find the animals. Just
yeah, I would say if I'm going with you and
yeah,
you
answer
have a tag,
for me.
I think it would be good to at least get into antelope. If we go out somewhere and we see pronghorn and we know we're in the right area and maybe we did something stupid like started cracking up laughing and they ran off.
Yes.
At least we were in the right spot.
Totally. Like that's going to be so
success.
Fun. I think we're going to do that. Don't you?
I don't know, man.
I hope
do.
So. What answer do you want me to say? You tell me what answer you want, and then I'll say it. I'll say,
yeah.
What are some hunts that you went on that you weren't successful, but you still felt like it was?
Oh, I've got a perfect one for that. Yeah. Gosh, this goes back a ways, but really having elk herd dynamics click for the first time with my dad, bow hunting, figuring out like, okay, this is how this herd works. This is how they move. Here's kind of like the herd cow that's in charge. Here's the herd bull. These are the satellite bulls. And that was an unsuccessful hunt. Yeah. And still to this day, my dad kicks himself because the way we were set up, we called in a bunch of satellite bulls and we had found a 380 bull And it was like, okay, that's the herd bull. We had watched this thing. That's the one he wanted to kill. So it was a really cool experience calling in all these satellite bulls, figuring that stuff out. And I kind of had in the back of my mind, I looked at the terrain we were in and I whispered to him, hey, we need to crawl up to that knoll right there because that herd's going to come out of the pinyons and they're going to feed right down into that bull. And he pushed back on me. And sure enough, they came out right there. And we had this 380 bull at about 100, I think it was 107 or 103 yards. But it was such a gratifying experience for me to finally be like, okay, I understand the topography. I understand how these elk work. I know which one is kind of doing what in the herd and the roles they play in that herd. So I would chalk that up as like a super successful hunt just for me personally, despite the fact that at the end of it, all there was tag soup.
Oh, that's good. Couldn't answer that because I don't have enough experience to even know that that was an option.
Yeah.
So I picked that one. That's my answer too.
Okay. Even if you add the killing to a hunting experience, there's gratifying aspects to all of it. Why the deer run the way they run when they die, where they run to when they die. And then later down the road, you're not crisscrossing the landscape on your hands and knees trying to find specks of blood in the dirt. You go, okay, I could look at a map. I arrowed it here. Oh, here's a cut. Here's a creek. It's going to run downhill to water. There's still something you can figure out and go, oh, okay, like this is why this happens.
With my birds too. If we, you know, they get at the beginning of the season, they're on a tee perch. We're walking. We get two or three jackrabbits in a hunt. I'm usually, you know, I just want to get one jackrabbit and be done just because I don't want to decimate.
What do you do with them afterwards?
I clean them and then put them in the freezer and feed them to the birds later. At the beginning of the season, it's easy. We're doing really well. Then I take something and change it. So I'll put, just carry the birds on my fist. And, you know, they're only seeing the jackrabbits that we flush close.
Right.
And going after them, you know, and just making it a little bit more fair, I guess you would say. But you're learning every time and it's not, you know, it's more about the hunt and watching your birds hunt well and successfully rather than, oh, I killed eight rabbits.
Yeah.
You know, gotcha.
Just getting outside.
Yeah.
Yeah, hunting is fun. I think that's the aspect that a lot of people lose sight of is hunting is fun. It doesn't always have to be a super gnarly grind. Sometimes you get lucky and you're done on day one and you can hang out at camp. I can't thank you both enough for doing this. Sincerely, thanks for putting yourselves out there. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. And we could not have timed that any better because as we sit here, there are fire alarms going off in the building. So we're out of here for this weekend. Thank you to Legacy Sports International, home of the Howa Superlight, for sponsoring the show. Coming up next is Tom Gresham's Gun Talk.